This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to America Secret Wars, your podcast all about the forgotten, overlooked, and deliberately covered up times the United States has sent its military to fight or occupy foreign soil. My guest today is a writer, producer, researcher, and host of Gooned, a Shorty Award-winning investigative podcast on the troubled teen industry, and of Texas Twiggy, a podcast about the actor-producer Shelley Duvall. She also runs Los Audios, a bi-weekly newsletter about audio production in Los Angeles. Emma Lehman, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you so much. I'm good. We had a nice little earthquake this morning that rattled my brain around in my skull a little bit, so I'm awake and I'm ready.
Oh, good. The joys of Los Angeles.
Exactly. You never know. It could be a gas line. It could be an earthquake. It could be the big earthquake. You just got to wait and see.
Yeah. One day, the big one will happen, and it will still surprise everyone despite 100 years of talking about it.
Despite every time I reread that New York Times article, the really big one, just to like put the fear of God in me, it's still going to surprise me when it happens, and it's probably going to be in my lifetime.
You know, it's okay. Last time I went to Los Angeles, LA was beautiful, but I was flying in and out of Las Vegas, and it rained.
It has been the past, like in March, especially like February and March, it was raining consistently, and we have no infrastructure to deal with that. So they shut down about 2 miles of the freeway by my apartment because it was just too wet. It just did. They just had no... I think it was maybe 2.5 inches of rain, and they just had no way to deal with it. So they just shut down the whole freeway, and they were like, we don't know what this state of matter is, but we're going to have to figure out how to deal with it. It was such a headache.
I do love every time it rains in LA, the videos that people post of the Los Angeles River just dumping out into the ocean because there's nowhere else to store it, even though you're in, what, year 30 of a drought?
Exactly. And then it, you know, the ground is so dry, and they, my friends like up in the hills, or I have family like that a little farther south, and that just the landslides are insane. And you'll be driving up there and see, you know, something that closed from a landslide, and you're just approaching it, and you're like, yeah, this might landslide itself again into my car, and just have no way of knowing.
Oh, fun. Yeah. I was fortunate enough to grow up without natural disasters, and then moved to Missouri, where we get tornado sirens all the time, but we never actually see them where I live. And we get flooding. That's our big problem. And We had a full-on FEMA encampment at our local community center a couple years ago for flooding. So, yeah, water management is important, everybody.
Yeah, exactly. And they just never... It even hailed here or something. And, like, it doesn't happen that frequently, but you'd think at this point, they're like, yeah, like, they should realize that it will happen to some extent, and they need some infrastructure to deal with it. But every time it ends and it's just like, well, that sucked and will never happen again, so we don't have to address it. And then, of course, it does.
Yeah. Isn't that just the story of America?
Exactly. This history repeating itself in a different way, but a much smaller scale.
And we will be getting right to a lot of different but similar concepts today. And I do want to ask, I have a default question that I start everybody off with. Emma, what was your experience with history class in high school, college, earlier, however you want to answer that?
Oh, man, that's actually that's a good question. So I grew up in Virginia, like right outside of Washington, D.C., but our high school curriculum was Virginia curriculum. You know, technically below the Mason-Dixon line, and a couple years after I left my middle school, they had to get rid of all of our history textbooks because they were...
Oh, no.
Well, so the first issue was that they were just grammatically incorrect and had all these misspellings and like random different fonts, whatever. The second issue was that they blew by the entirety of history up to the present without ever mentioning Japanese internment. They just never said anything about it. There were a few other gross historical inaccuracies or like very conspicuous, you know, like very conspicuously not mentioning certain things that mostly things that were the fault of the U.S. And they just never mentioned it. So they got rid of those textbooks shortly after I left. And the other thing with growing up basically in D.C. was, you know, I don't know how the curriculum was for kids in California here, but you have a few years where you learn about your state specifically as opposed to the country. But because we were in D.C., a lot of that was skewed more towards national politics than state specific. So I was so much more politically informed than I gave myself credit for, or honestly, than I should have been as like an actual child. And I remember having an opinion about, you know, the history of like education, like that. I remember having an argument about Betsy DeVos when I was like 12, and I came to California and would have or try to have political conversations or, you know, anything really informed by history with fully baked adults that I worked with, you know, my coworkers with kids. And I remember a couple years ago when I worked at Trader Joe's, I had mentioned something about it was January 6th. And I was like, you know, oh, it's the anniversary of January 6th. And she kind of looked at me and she was like, is that your birthday? And I was like, no, January 6th. And she was like, yeah, I don't, you know, it's birthday anniversary. And so I didn't realize until moving and also, you know, obviously I don't know as much about California specific history as a lot of people here do, but I realized very quickly that I was much more historically and politically informed than I gave myself credit for, as were a lot of my friends. And, you know, to this day, my friends who moved here from DC, from Virginia, from kind of that DMV, DC, Maryland, Virginia area, they're the only ones who are willing to engage in politics and history with me for as long as I want to. And we just, yeah, sometimes we'll look back at stuff that was in the curriculum and just be like, and you know, I was born in 2000, I'm 23, almost 24. So this was like 2012 to 2018 that I was in, you know, middle school through high school. So it was not nearly long enough ago that I feel like it should be able to be explained how insane some of that curriculum was. And, you know, I mean, I think everybody, once you become more informed, especially if you do, you know, go to college and learn a lot about the more nuanced parts of history, I think everyone looks back on things they were taught as a kid and is like, wait, what the hell? But there were specifically, I just remember my friend's younger siblings going to the same schools that I did. And I was like, oh, they got rid of those textbooks. And he was like, yeah, because they had some pretty glaring issues with them. And I was like, dang, that's what was taught to me. And it was crazy to think about. Luckily, I, you know, managed to took some history classes in college. And I just am a very curious person. And I would even then would look things up. But there were things I just didn't know about because they were never taught to me. And looking back on that, it's kind of scary to think, like, obviously, if you don't tell a kid about something that their country did or anything historical, like, they're not going to know. Why would they? And it's scary to think that if I hadn't happened to, you know, be interested in history and stuff like that, like, there's a huge chance that I just never would have rectified those things that were taught to me. I wish I could remember the name of the textbook, but I do remember what the cover looked like. And even the cover was very poorly photoshopped. So I say good riddance to them, but that's probably my biggest recollection of being taught history as a kid.
No, that's good, because this is a podcast about the stuff that they leave out of textbooks almost universally. And that did bring up deep-seated memory somewhere in me that my elementary school history textbook 1 year only ever referred to the American Revolution as the war.
Oh, good.
Because it was the only war in the book.
Oh, even better. Even I have seen friends of mine who grew up deeper in the South. There are actual, like, I don't know if they were textbooks, but there were certainly worksheets they were given that would refer to the Civil War as the War of Northern Aggression, you know, in the 2000s and 2010s. So, yeah.
Yeah. The South won't rise again, because has anybody looked at it? But yeah, well, we might be getting to that. But getting towards our topic for the day, have you ever heard of a minor incident in the 60s when the United States invaded a Southeast Asian jungle in response to a naval disaster, fought a vastly outnumbered and under-equipped army of local guerrillas, had to abandon the territory in exhaustion without achieving any of their stated goals, and used that situation to strengthen relations with China?
Sounds vaguely familiar. Yeah, that seems like something I might know about.
See, here's the thing. What event are you thinking of?
I'm thinking of the Vietnam War.
I did word that very specifically, but we're not talking about Vietnam today. And to quote a meme, if I had a nickel for every war that fit that bizarrely specific description, I'd actually probably have about a dollar. Today we are going to talk about a much smaller, much shorter conflict 100 years earlier. This is going to be about the Formosa Expedition of 1867.
Huh. I hate that the first thing that comes to my mind is there's a restaurant near me called Formosa Cafe. I wonder if there's a relation.
There almost certainly is, but don't worry about it too much, because that's just an alternative, kind of outdated now name for the island of Taiwan.
Interesting. I did not know that. Huh. I never made that connection, actually.
Yeah, it's a linguistic quirk of which language, which European language borrowed the name for the island from.
It is indeed a Taiwanese restaurant. Amazing.
There you go.
Huh.
So I hadn't heard of this either until I started doing research for this show and kept running into it, oddly enough. Basically, as a topic on obscure military history websites when I was looking for information about other episodes. It is a bit funny whenever I have to visit those sites trying to find more information or sources, because they come up with some really obscure topics and tend to have real, real bad politics.
I feel like sometimes, though, I'll reach the opinion part of a website like that and be like, wait, this indicates that I can't even trust the facts that were just fed to me based on the opinion part that I am now reading. And that's happened to me during researching for stuff so many times.
Yeah, I have done a lot of vetting over the course of researching the first few episodes of this show. this was actually one of the first episodes I started researching and writing for this show. And then as I got more into it, I realized this fits better into a kind of sequence of episodes we're doing on American imperialism in Eastern Asia, because we're going to intersect with a couple of different other conflicts that we found ourselves involved in the mid-19th century. Before we get into any real history of the event we're actually talking about, it's fair to say that prior to the 1890s, the United States wasn't exactly a global superpower on the same level as, say, the British Empire. But that does not mean that we didn't have warships all over the fucking globe doing their absolute best to make sure everything kept coming up in favor of the USA. And over the course of this whole podcast, I am going to talk a lot about weird little naval incidents that turned into the United States exchanging blood and bullets in every corner of the world. So, Emma, do you know anything about the general history of Taiwan? Is probably a good place to start.
You know, funny enough, my boyfriend and his family are Taiwanese, and he's not super into history, but again, I'm very curious. It's something that I was actually recently writing a script somewhat related more about the CCP than anything, but obviously, you know, to do history on that, you kind of have to begin in the Chiang Kai-shek adjacent territory. And so I would say that I know maybe more than the average person, but I am by no means an expert. And every time that I learn something new, I realize that there is even more background behind that that I also don't know. Case in point, this right here.
Yeah. And I think that's the case for even a lot of people who do know a lot about recent Taiwanese history. Is there is a very big turning point with the Chinese Civil War in the 1950s and Chiang Kai-shek moving his government to the island. It is a reset button, effectively, on the story of Taiwanese history. Not in that nothing before matters, but in the way that we're able to talk about it. What I think a lot of people talking about modern Taiwan tend to overlook is that historically, it is not a Chinese island. It is an island near China that interacted a lot with China, but people first started making their way there around 17,000 years ago, and actually more waves of migration came there from the Philippines than from the Asian mainland.
I do know I learned a few days ago that Hokkien, the Taiwanese dialect, is spoken in the Philippines, and I remember being very confused by that, but that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Taiwan spent most of its history, thousands of years, mostly isolated from the rest of the world. This wasn't a political policy of any sort. There wasn't any sort of uniting government for the whole island to enforce something like that. The surrounding nations just didn't take a lot of interest. Half the island is covered in mountains, which doesn't make it a particularly appealing place for pre-modern invaders to try and take over and exploit, because there's not a lot of resources on half of the landmass to begin with. But this allowed local indigenous cultures to spring up and develop more or less independently, aside from some occasional trade and interaction with mostly Japan and China. By the 16th century, the island, I just got done talking about Japan, so I'll probably pluralize that a few times. It was home to about 24 distinct ethnic groups with their own cultural nuances and languages and dialects, but the main division was between the lowland on the western side of the island and the highland mountains on the eastern side. These indigenous groups did have their own tradition of agriculture and metallurgy and textile production, but they were still primarily hunting and fishing cultures. But that started to change when China's Ming Dynasty made a more concerted effort to trade with the island and establish permanent trade connections and trade routes, eventually settling their own little port colonies on Taiwan. And then white people showed up, which is the repeated story of a lot of this show.
Tends to only go downhill from that point, but
yeah, in this case it was the Portuguese. Some of the early Portuguese traders even bumped into the island, and they called it Ilha Formosa, meaning the beautiful island. And that is where one of the primary European names for the island came from for about 300 years. Meanwhile, the Chinese were calling it Taiyuan, going off of the name of one of the largest tribes on the western side of the island, and that's where we get the name Taiwan from. If I quote anything today, it will probably say Formosa, because that's the historical terminology, but I'm going to use the modern name. So we fast forward a few centuries. The 17th century saw a lot of colonial competition. The Ming Chinese were never really able to dedicate their full attention to the island due to their own internal conflicts. The Portuguese never really needed it because they had bases in mainland China. So it came down to the Dutch and the Spanish. And they carved out chunks on the western side as their own colonial holdings, trying to keep up with the Portuguese. All this really succeeded in doing was force the natives whose land was being stolen by these colonial empires to band together into tribal coalitions and fight back. And by the end of that century, an indigenous alliance had allied with the Dutch to kick out the Chinese and the Spanish, who were then kicked out when China went through a revolution and was now ruled by the Qing Dynasty, who had to chase their competitors out of Taiwan as well. So going into the period that we're really focused on today, we have Qing China and the indigenous Taiwanese, but the colonial Europeans who are swarming all around Taiwan and trading with initially China and India and eventually Japan, they're not doing much with Taiwan just yet. Even the Chinese mostly wanted to focus on the lowland side of the island because that's where all of the good farmland was that they could exploit and make use out of. So the eastern side of the island became a safe haven for pirates. Basically, every government in the world agrees that violent raiders attacking ships are bad for business. So anybody who could was allowed to try and fight piracy, but without a strong local naval power, it was difficult to make the waters around Taiwan safe for shipping pretty far into the 1800s. And since the indigenous Highlanders didn't really like anybody the pirates were preying on, they didn't see a problem with them sharing the coastline as base of operations.
Enemy of my enemy is my friend, I guess.
More or less. That is a lot of colonial Taiwanese politics is various little alliances always with the indigenous communities trying to retain as much of their land rights as possible. It's actually a lot like the first couple of decades of United States history, where you get these tribal coalitions, they get support from Spain or Britain or whichever to fight the Americans, so the Americans can't expand, but then alliances shift, political demands shift, and the only people who really get screwed over in the end are the people who actually live there.
Yeah.
Because history is fun like that.
Woohoo.
And while all of this was happening in the Pacific, North America was colonized. A few of those colonies overthrew the British. They decided to be a United States of America. And at the same time, the Qing Dynasty was stabilizing and expanding Chinese colonization into Taiwan. The U.S. rapidly branched across the entirety of North America to control most of its modern territory.
Trying to follow in my head, I feel like I know the specificity, like the specific parts of history I know of different parts of the world are all from like different time periods. So it's hard for me to kind of make sure that it's all meshing, but I think I'm following pretty well.
Yeah. I mean, this is just really brief overview of hundreds of years to kind of get us where we need to be. So all of that said, the United States really wasn't the country we would recognize today until about 1866, because a third of the continental U.S. was still considered unincorporated territory, and for the most part, our government was still fighting to actually control the western half of that and take it from its native peoples. The Southeast was under military occupation because we had just finished the Civil War, and the policies of Reconstruction were just in their beginning phase. Hawaii was still an independent kingdom, and a lot of our overseas territories that we still have weren't conquered for another few decades during the Spanish-American War.
We like to tease my dad that he was born when there were still 48 states in the Union, because he was born in January of 59. So I think that Alaska came very shortly after he was born, and then Hawaii shortly thereafter. But it is factually true that he was born when there were 48 states, and he absolutely hates when we tell him that every single time.
You know, it's not that long ago.
But it makes him sound so elderly, and it just cracks me up.
That's fair. Yeah. You were born under a different flag, literally, is
exactly
does make the passage of time feel more potent, I guess. Well, coincidentally, our story for today starts just a couple of weeks before the Alaska Purchase, and it ends a few months before the annexation of Midway Island. We are in that kind of expansion phase while all of this is happening. I am sure that I'll talk about different dimensions of it as we go, but the important thing to understand is that in the decade or two before the Civil War, the United States had gone from an important regional power to a continent-spanning empire that believed strongly in its own manifest destiny to spread specifically American-style democratic republicanism to the rest of the world. And part of that was a series of wars, a series of land purchases, and culminating in our own civil war to kind of decide what exactly that form of government would look like in the long run, and who would get to count as part of it. But a civil war also leads to a boom in military equipment in general, and in this case, naval capacity in particular. The United States Navy almost tripled in size over the course of our Civil War. And since in the 1850s, we had used our limited naval power to force Japan to accept trade with Western nations, and a decade before that, we had participated in the Opium Wars in China. We now had a lot of trade interests on the far side of the Pacific, which led to an expansion of our naval presence across the entirety of the ocean.
Makes sense.
In the 19th century in general, from a very early point, we had a series of small naval squadrons in different regions of the entire world. Almost immediately after the War of 1812, we started fanning these things out. But this is the point after our Civil War where they start to be effective. And we started participating in anti-piracy operations, which were often code for punish natives who didn't want us on their island.
So not like banning LimeWire, not that kind of anti-piracy.
No.
Pirates Bay, what were the other ones? Napster?
Yeah. Napster's weirdly now a legit streaming service, which I always find really funny.
Oh, really?
Because it actually pays better royalties than any other music streamer now.
That is a hell of a rebrand. I might look into that. I did not know that.
Yeah, it's a I assume like they sold the name at some point just on that notoriety value, but that's a weird thing to have.
Huh. I mean, good to know. Good for them. They're above board now. They have a checkered past, but they've come back to morality. I love it. Yes.
What I haven't checked, but I desperately want to know if Metallica streams on modern Napster.
Oh my gosh. I'm going to remind myself to check that.
For anybody really under the age of 30, which includes both of us, but we know more about this than we have any right to, Metallica sued Napster in the first big anti-piracy lawsuit of the modern internet.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if they do stream on it now, it's in a way of kind of sticking it to the previous owners of Napster, but...
Yeah, maybe.
You know, passive aggression, perhaps.
Well, you wouldn't download a car? Ship? You know, while we're talking about a streaming service, I'll throw in an ad break because maybe it'll be for a streamer. Who knows?
There you go. It's perfect.
In his final days, Alexander the Great's generals asked him who should succeed him. Alexander's answer, the strongest. Taken literally, this would see the close of the classical Greek age, an age thousands of years in the making. Join me, Mark Selleck, as I go back to retell the story of ancient Greece in my series Casting Through Ancient Greece. We will cast our way back to its beginnings, all the way through to the spread of its culture throughout the known world, thanks to Alexander and his generals. You can listen and subscribe to the series at www.castingthroughancientgreece.com, or you can listen on your favourite podcasting platform. Don't forget to follow the series over on Twitter at Casting Greece or on Facebook at Casting Through Ancient Greece. I look forward to seeing you there.
All right, we are back, and our real story begins, and I am 100% serious about this, with Peter Parker.
Good? Question mark?
Unfortunately, instead of being a vigilante with spider powers, this Peter Parker was a Presbyterian minister with an MD from Yale. He was also the on-again, off-again acting ambassador of the United States to China in Guangzhou, then known as Canton to Westerners, and he is often credited as the most successful missionary, both for Christianity and Western medicine in China.
I was going to say, I feel like the phrase successful missionary has some connotations to it that don't necessarily indicate a positive version of the word success, but
yeah,
go Parker.
In China especially, around this time, the spread of Protestantism was a contentious issue because they had just fought the Taiping Rebellion led by Hong Christ, the younger brother of Jesus, who received revelation after failing the state bureaucracy exam too many times.
Which testament is that in, new or old?
I think that's the like fifth or sixth one at this point.
Perfect.
I'm not sure if this episode will come out before or after the Opium Wars episodes, but bizarre story to say the least.
I'm excited.
Though in this case, I think that it just means that Peter Parker convinced more people to become Christian than anybody else, because the Qing government tended to have a pretty hard lockdown on aggressive proselytization within their borders. It was one of the main points of the treaties that ended the Opium Wars was an official system for missionaries in China. So Spider Doctor achieved this position after the British victory in the First Opium War, a conflict literally fought to make sure the Brits could keep selling opiates in the Chinese market without any regulation to speak of. And the United States had leveraged the opening of Chinese ports after that to really gain our first foothold in Asian markets. In 1848, on the eve of the Second Opium War and that Taiping Rebellion I mentioned, Dr. Parker received word that American sailors and merchants on board a British ship went down in a storm off the coast of Taiwan. This report came from survivors of another British shipwreck, passing on rumors of white castaways that had been enslaved by indigenous tribes on the island, including a ship whose name in the indigenous language vaguely resembled that of some of the missing Americans. So Parker immediately called on Commander W.S. Walker of the U.S. East India Squadron to investigate these rumors and allegations. If you are at all familiar with how military chain of command is supposed to work, you may know that it's not really up to an acting ambassador and a mid-ranking commissioned officer to send forces into foreign territory, regardless of whether or not there were prisoners there. But this was the 19th century, and communication was slow. Commander Walker was the highest-ranking officer in the vicinity, and Parker was the highest-ranking civilian representative. So standard procedure at the time was that these two could conduct a mission like this without much reprimand, as long as they played it safe. They will not play it safe.
As long as they do the thing they specifically didn't.
Yes. That's also the story of a lot of America's secret wars, is people who had very specific rules they could follow and do whatever they wanted within those confines and repeatedly ignore it.
Rules were made to be broken.
Yeah, if anybody has listened to all of my episodes so far, you'll know that this is a pattern that exists in this episode in 1867 and also in the episode I did on Niger set in 2021. While the commander was making plans to dispatch a sloop of war, a relatively small warship with about 20 cannons on a single deck, Representative Parker was hiring Chinese merchants and British traders to investigate all of these claims. At the time, the Brits were the only non-Chinese people allowed to trade on Taiwan, and eventually the British were able to secure the release of the captives, who really were being held hostage by some of the inland tribes on the island, but none of them were actually American. So not much came of Parker and Walker's plans for this expedition, and before long they had larger concerns. American naval forces fought in the Second Opium War, there were concessions, then our Civil War happened, and of course, since China didn't actually control about two-thirds of the island, and the area was filled with pirates, there was a healthy black market that developed while every imperial power in the region was getting involved in different conflicts. So this expansion in trade was a driving force in rapidly rising rates of immigration between China and the United States, which I think you'll be plenty familiar with in Los Angeles.
Definitely. I think that... I had a roommate my first year of college who was tutoring me in Chinese. In exchange, I would buy us an absolutely obscene quantity of dim sum every weekend. Can't remember if it was Saturday or Sunday, but we would frustrate ourselves with about an hour and a half of Chinese tutoring that, bless her heart, she tried so hard, went nowhere. I can now say, where is the bathroom? Give me money and I'm cold. Also, Apple. And then we would go and just absolutely stuff ourselves with dim sum, and it was a great trade. But she was the one who basically taught me to use chopsticks, which came in a lot, came in very handy when I met my boyfriend's family, and thankfully did not embarrass myself. But she was wonderful, and she is a large part of the reason that I know how to order off a dim sum menu and know what to pick off the carts that doesn't have mushrooms, which I'm allergic to, and the reason that I can use chopsticks. So I appreciate her very much. And she's actually currently back home, but she was great. And again, credit her for some of my favorite food and my mediocre but passable chopstick
ability. Now I want dim sum. no, that's fine.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. The You do have the vocabulary to give someone the strangest mugging story of all time. I'll say that.
Exactly. I can ask something that's objectively pretty rude. I can make sure that I can pee. And then I guess I could ask for a very small, specific snack that I might eventually get tired of. But that's all you really need, right?
No. What snacks, the bathroom, and demands for money. I think that covers all of your basic needs. Yeah.
That's Maslow's hierarchy right there. That's perfect.
You're all set. You can move across the Pacific now. No problems.
Perfect.
So I should acknowledge that many, if not most, of the Chinese immigrants into the United States at this time were kidnapping victims or debt peons who were effectively slave labor, despite the fact that slavery had now been abolished in the United States. But regardless of that, this increased connection with China did make East Asia an even more critical part of the American economy. And as we all know, in 2024, that's all that ever matters. This led to the U.S. seeking bases of operations in the region. We, at this point, had pretty strong connections with Japan, though they were undergoing their own political turmoil by now. But for the most part, there was a lack of coal depots. And this was the age of steam shipping, so there was nowhere for Americans to refuel at a cost-effective rate. We could go to British or Japanese or French or whichever locations and colonies, but they charged marked up rates for foreigners, which could sometimes make the entire trip a net loss. So the United States was looking for somewhere they could set up their own larger coal station and even maybe take ownership of a local coal mine. In my episodes about our interactions with Japan in the 1860s, I mentioned that Commodore Matthew Perry stopped over in Taiwan looking to settle a colony there. And even though nothing came of that, the idea settled into Peter Parker's mind and became a frequent topic of discussion in U.S. foreign policy. Kind of set to the side during the Civil War for obvious reasons, but once that wasn't the only thing to talk about, it came right back up of, could we take over all of Taiwan?
See, now I'm imagining Matthew Perry, the other Matthew Perry, in a room with, like, any one of the Spider-Man actors having this discussion, but I don't actually mind that too much, so.
Matthew Perry from Friends, and I think Andrew Garfield would be the funniest one here to discussing the conquest of Taiwan.
I think that would be a really productive foreign policy discussion, I'm sure.
I am glad you pointed that out because my brother didn't get the name connections between Matthew Perry's when I did an episode with him. So that will, people will appreciate that somebody got the pop culture references. To read from a 1857 memo to the State Department from Peter Parker, Great Britain has her St. Helena in the Atlantic, her Gibraltar and Malta in the Mediterranean, her Aden, Mauritius, Ceylon, Penang, and Singapore in the Indian Ocean, and her Hong Kong in the China Seas. If the United States was so disposed and could arrange, his emphasis, not mine, for the possession of Formosa, England could certainly not object. England has so many colonies, they couldn't get mad at us if we wanted one too. What's that? The Chinese and the indigenous people of the island? Why would we care?
Has not historically stopped anyone, so.
No, never. Not once. So Spider-Man did gain some traction among fellow diplomats in China, American merchants, and members of the State Department, primarily, but nothing came of their proposals. There were naval forces in the region, but not nearly enough, and way too much of North America was still, as I said, contested with its own native inhabitants to send a massive invasion force across the entire Pacific to conquer an island. We weren't quite there yet. Taiwan was also partly a no-go because it quickly became apparent that it would lead to conflict with basically any country that had a boat. Despite that memo that I read, the British were also eyeing up Taiwan. The Chinese were already there. Japan was looking at it too. And even Prussia, with a P, was starting to think about building a colonial empire in the Pacific. Germany, not quite a thing yet. None of that stopped Peter Parker from conspiring with the Commodore of the East India Squadron to simply annex the island by force of arms as revenge against the Chinese for attacking U.S. forces during the Opium War, which isn't a thing that happened. There was one exchange where they initiated an attack on the U.S., and the ship they attacked immediately burned down a series of forts, so I feel like that was already recompense.
Or maybe it was, is preemptive revenge a thing? He's like, just in case this is a thing that ever happens, yeah. I'm going to enact revenge now.
He could actually tell the future vaguely knew that 200 years later, it would be a race between China and the United States for global hegemony and wanted to get a head start.
Perfect.
Yeah, just revenge by conquering an island that's only tangentially related to what you're talking about is an odd plan. So not much changed in the broader scope of Sino-American relations during the 1860s, partly because both countries were just really busy with their own internal problems. But then an American ship called the Rover was shuttling trade goods from south to north along the Chinese coast. It intended to make a stop in the Ryukyu Islands and trade with the Japanese or with pirates, maybe based on the side of Taiwan, along the way, when it ran aground on a coral reef just at the southern tip of the island. The survivors who made it ashore were not welcomed by the native inhabitants. They washed up in territory controlled by the Botan tribe of the Paiwan people. And an indigenous culture that had absolutely no interest whatsoever in cooperating with foreigners who kept plundering their island, drawing pirates into their waters, and killing their neighbors. So the Botan killed everyone who survived the initial crash, including the captain's wife and several British and American nationals. The only survivor was a Chinese sailor who had been hired to work on the Rover. He had a vague sense of where he was because he was able to flee along the coast to the nearest Qing outpost and bring news of what had happened to the Chinese authorities, who then reported it to the British, who sent a sloop to land in Paiwan territory themselves, where they were met by a barrage of gunfire from the locals and forced to flee from the beaches.
Sloop is a great word.
Yeah, we don't have them anymore.
It's fun to say. I like sloop. Oh, did we decommission that model?
Yeah, no more sloops. It just seems so much more inventive than battleship.
Yeah, it's a little less threat. It's like, if I'm being encroached upon by a sloop, I'm not going to shoot at a sloop. Like a battleship, yeah, I'm guns ablazing, you know, but a sloop, like that's
we
too-
keep I'll the military keeps rebranding sloop. Things to sound cute. Less evil empire-y, so maybe we'll bring back those old sailing terminology names just to calm things down a bit. No more destroyers and battleships. We've got sloops and gun whales again.
Bring back the sloop 2024. A better public-facing branding for weaponry.
That is a significant part of the American economy. That's why Boeing makes airplanes. Makes, quote unquote.
Boeing commission. Yeah, gosh. Do they never really they never fully construct them. They make them to an extent and then they just kind of send them out and see what happens.
Well, you know, when you're growing up, you make them with balsa wood and glue. That should work the same way for a 747.
Exactly. And then Boeing hires you when you're still doing that.
Just don't sit in an exit row. You'll be fine.
Exactly. If the Boeing is Spirit Airlines, like you're already ready to just hit the ground with no wheels or plunge into the ocean, so you know you're halfway there.
See, that's the one time when the lack of legroom on Spirit might actually save you. There's not enough space for you to get sucked out. You'll just run into the other seats.
Oh, yeah. You're already trapped under the armrest, so it doesn't even matter if you're wearing a seatbelt.
Yeah. There we go. Spirit inadvertent safety features.
Perfect. They should advertise. They can, I mean, it's your podcast, but I think that they can take that and use it in their ads. I think that's fair if they give you some royalties.
Yes. If you give me the ad copy to read, Spirit, I'll do it.
Perfect sponsorship opportunity.
Spirit, so small you're not in danger for when the plane falls apart.
When? Not if.
Well,
when?
Speaking of trade and commerce,
hello and bonjour. My name is Josh Zucker, and I want to take you on a journey through some of the most exciting events of the late Middle Ages. Valois Burgundy was one of the medieval world's greatest what-ifs. Its dukes inherited, conquered, and politicked their way into forging a state between the German Empire and the Kingdom of France that rivaled them both. From the Hundred Years' War to the Holy Roman Empire, from urban workers to Joan of Arc, and from gallant knights to gunpowder weapons, the Grand Dukes of the West had a part to play in almost all of Western Europe's biggest developments in the 14th and 15th centuries. If you want to learn more about the glamorous rise and dramatic fall of the Dukes of Burgundy, please join me for Grand Dukes of the West, A History of Valois Burgundy.
The merchant ship Rover is now lost, and understandably, the Western consulates in China were upset and angered by this. At least a dozen British and American merchant ships had wrecked along the Taiwanese coast since trade with China opened 20 years earlier. In the most notable incident, the crew of a British merchant ship called the Anne washed up on Taiwanese shores, only for every sailor on board to be beheaded. In 1861 and 1862, respectively, the American ships Iskendria and Lucky Star both went down off the same coastline and had their crews taken captive and ransomed back. And on both occasions, the American consulate demanded reparations from the Chinese government, which denied them both times because these people were not Chinese subjects. However, because China claimed territorial control over all of Taiwan, the Treaty of Tientsin, which ended the Second Opium War, held them legally liable for damages incurred anywhere in Chinese territory. And as Leonard H.D. Gordon put it in his very useful book, Confrontation Over Taiwan, a claim for indemnity would require evidence of the complicity of Chinese officials in pilfering a wrecked vessel. Consequently, the only ground for a complaint was that their power was weak and their aid useless against the violence of the natives. Which is an effective summary of the state of Chinese politics in the 1860s, really. After 200 years of trying to occupy and control Taiwan, the Qing dynasty exerted basically no control over the indigenous highlanders, and they didn't even pretend to. God only knows what exactly made the Rover incident stand out in all this. Maybe it was just that the U.S. had the military force to intervene at this point. But Charles Legendre, a French immigrant to the United States, turned U.S. consul and Peter Parker's replacement, decided that this was the last straw. Legendre and the Chinese officials he met with and his British counterpart spent the weeks following the Rover incident with meetings with their Chinese officials, getting decidedly mixed messages. Both English-speaking delegations offered military aid to help the Qing government deal with the situation on Taiwan, but the Chinese didn't exactly trust English promises at this point and refused all aid. They insisted that they would help, or they would handle it themselves, and then never did anything about that.
That tends to be what I do when I say I'll handle something myself, is just not handle it.
No. I'll get to that. I'll clear that inbox.
I'm like, thanks for the offer, but I can put this aside in perpetuity myself, but I appreciate the offer.
Unsurprisingly, Legendre decided that the United States could take the Chinese statement to heart. If the Paiwan and other Taiwanese natives were not Chinese subjects, then it was totally okay for the U.S. to act on its own militarily. They would have to operate in Chinese waters. So he did inform the Chinese government of his plan to quote-unquote punish the bandits who attacked the rover. This put Americans in an uneasy position, though. Legendre was calling for blood, and the Chinese government was sorta, kinda, maybe allowing it. But with the Opium Wars still in everyone's mind, the American government wasn't actually on board with this plan. But since all of the local consuls were on board, and word hadn't reached North America yet that they were going to do this, they got the go-ahead. Ansem Burlingame, the first official U.S. minister to the Qing court, had arrived earlier that year as Legendre's new boss, and he and the British consul in Hong Kong agreed to support this intervention on Taiwan. The British consul was also thinking about how this could support British colonization of the island, just like the Americans wanted it to support American colonization of the island. Because everybody just had one goal at this point in history.
Always top of mind.
Now, why they wanted colonies with exactly 0 acres of inhabitable territory is beyond me, but they were just going to kind of go for it. So Legendre had already contacted and dispatched Rear Admiral H.H. Bell of the American East Indies Squadron to attack the Paiwan tribes, under the popular belief of the day that the U.S. government would eventually authorize a wholesale occupation. He sailed on the squadron's flagship, the USS Hartford, a steam sloop, and he was a veteran of several of the most important campaigns of the U.S. Civil War. He brought a friend of the show, the USS Wyoming, along for good measure, which had previously been the flagship tasked with invading the Choshu domain in Japan.
You know, this is a little bit discursive at this point, but if we did change battleships back to sloops, would we also have to change the game battleship, where you like put all the things in the board and pin them down? Because I feel like naming that game Sloop might kind of not hit the same as the game battleship. You know, do you want to play Sloop? Just doesn't quite sound as fun.
No, it sounds like a chess variant.
Yeah, it sounds like the slow, like the modification of the game that takes a little bit longer and isn't as fun. So maybe we shouldn't rename battleships to sloops. However, again, if the U.S. military in its infinite budget does want to pay either of us royalties for that campaign of rebranding, again,
or you know,
we are.
Even if you don't want to do that, nobody knows where that money comes from or where it goes. It's fine. Just you can give it to me.
Exactly. You give me a couple billion. You won't even. That's not even the. B isn't even the number that the budget starts with. It starts with a T. You won't notice it's gone. I can pay rent forever. Go for it.
The difference between $1 billion and $1 trillion is about $1 trillion. So go, spread it around, guys.
Yeah, it's crazy when I feel like there are, when I was looking recently at the richest people in the world, and it's like, the difference between the richest man in the world and the 12th richest man in the world. Like if you gave me that much money, I would not notice a difference between even something like you give me 50 million versus 500 million. I am going to do the exact same thing with my life that I would do with 50 million. If I have 500 million, I feel like there's a certain amount of money past which it just does not make a difference. Like you can only buy so many houses. You can only pay rent in LA so many times. Although, that may well be the thing that would make me notice the difference between 50 and 500 million.
Owning property in LA.
Oh my God. That's such a pipe dream that it's like not even, Sometimes I feel like we had a construction site outside of my apartment, and when they loaded out and finished construction, they left one porta potty, and I was like, I could probably rent this out on Craigslist for like 4 digits a month if I phrased it right. Like rustic outdoor small efficiency bachelor studio apartment, full bathroom, connect with nature.
I think you could.
I could do it. I think I could. I think that could be a great supplement.
I have seen when I was considering or potentially moving out there, like 100 square foot closets being rented at four figures. So you could do it.
Oh yeah. I toured an apartment once and I was like, this is cute, I guess. Where's the bathroom? And she started listing the nearby restaurants. And I was like, that's not what I asked. Where's the bathroom? There was a long silence before I understood that the reason she was listing the restaurants was there was no bathroom. And this was an illegal apartment. And those restaurants were where the tenant would be using the bathroom. I never asked about a shower. I imagine she would have started telling me where there were garden supply stores where I could get a hose. But that apartment was 14 something a month, like $1,400 and some odd dollars. So it was cheap for LA, but it also
that would
had
be a deal breaker.
No bathroom. So, you know, it's not up to code. And I have shared bathroom. I've shared a single bathroom with seven or six other women before, which is an ordeal, but at least I knew that it was there. But you know, the listing's not up anymore, but, if it got to that point, I feel like I would just say, I'm going to move to a lower cost of living state and just handle it that way.
I didn't get a say in it. LA just decided, or UCLA just decided they didn't want me. So I went to a lower cost of living state by default.
You know, they decided they wanted me. And then when I told them that my family had been living here for several years, I was like, can I get in-state tuition? And they were like, no. So they got, maybe they... since in-state is about half out-of-state tuition, maybe they just were getting out of me double tuition as a way of honorarily having you attend for 4 years. Like, we will eke out of this one student double the money, and then we don't have to accept another.
And then they can use that money to buy another swath of East Hollywood. All right, let's see. Oh, yes, they brought the USS Wyoming, friend of the show. This was a meaningful percentage, these two ships, of our overall force in the region at the time. And it was just a punitive campaign, theoretically, but also a probing kind of scouting mission to see how much an invasion of Taiwan would actually take. And this finally brings us to the actual battle on the island when the Formosa expedition arrived, or on June 13th, 1867, when the Hartford and Wyoming reached the southeastern corner of Taiwan and sent 180 Marines ashore with their commander, George Belknap, because we just don't name them like we used to.
How do you spell that?
B-E-L-K-N-A-P.
Huh. I don't know what I expected. Belknap.
Yeah, kind like of one of the paunchier-faced, more British-looking cats. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The smushy ones that kind of like that. Belknap. Oh, distinguished gentleman. Only eats the fancy feast that comes in the extra tall cans with the whole fish in it. Got himself a Belknap right there.
Commander Belknap split his Marines into two columns, with the second one under command of Lieutenant Commander Alexander Mackenzie. As these two lines of troops marched into the Taiwanese jungle, 20 Marines were taken out of formation and put ahead of the line as a skirmishing force, the, you know, point of first contact. They were the dudes who would intercept any approaching enemies and fire at them from cover while the guys behind them got into position for a bigger fight. In this case, that also meant they were the ones clearing brush out of the way with machetes and axes to clear a path through dense, unprocessed jungle.
This is beginning to sound somewhat familiar.
But here's the thing. The Marines, they have a reputation. There's a lot of ways you could phrase that. Some of them have to do with glue. Some of them have to do with crayons. My personal favorite is the acronym, Muscles Are Required, Intelligence Non-Essential.
I'll just say I went to high school with some eventual Marines, and I don't disagree.
For the sake of being fair and balanced, like all righteous, God-ordained, red-blooded American media, that is a joke. And it is specifically about the low-ranking grunts on the ground of the Modern Corps. However, it's pretty apt here because we've got 181 Marines sent in to basically do a drive-by on the Paiwan in a turf war, even if it's a turf war over a whole island. But street gangs would know something about the place they were going. Remember all those ships that attacked or were crash-landed in this area before? None of them could make contact or interact safely with the Paiwan because the Paiwan didn't fucking want them there. They didn't have any strategic intelligence to speak of when they invaded, and they just assumed that the Paiwan were a disorganized array of uncivilized barbarians. Of course, there's no such thing in the first place, which the Americans should really have known after a century of fighting their own indigenous people. But to top it off, the Paiwan in particular had recently undergone a major political shift. Like the other indigenous Taiwanese cultures, the Paiwan were divided into tribes, 18 in all. And unlike most of the other natives of Taiwan, the Paiwan had a mainland-esque system of hereditary aristocracy. One of these nobles, Takatak of the Skaro tribe, had spent years before the Formosa expedition fighting and conquering and unifying all of the Paiwan under his rule. So not only were these people better organized than the Americans anticipated, they had a lot more manpower and a competent leader, an experienced leader, who could direct their campaign when the Americans arrived. On the American side of things, it turned into a disaster before they even made contact. They were marching on foot through southern Taiwan in June, wearing their underway uniforms, which meant heavy wool pants and jackets that were for keeping you warm at sea.
I really thought you were going to say wearing their underwear. Damn. I mean, I imagine they were wearing that too, but it seems a little cold for that to have been the only thing.
That, also wool.
Wool is so itchy. You got to have something in between the two. I really hope they had a base layer.
I don't know, it was 1867. Cotton was hard to come by at the time.
Fair point.
General Sherman had really cut down on the national cotton supply.
The Fabric of Our Lives ad campaign wouldn't come for a couple centuries, so.
No, at this point, the fabric of their lives was wool, and they were in a tropical jungle.
Oh, can't even imagine.
So after an hour of blindly tromping through the forest, the Marines were already becoming exhausted and overheated thanks to their uniforms and the climate, and the skirmishers most of all because they had to physically clear their path. It wasn't a total disaster yet, and none of the ships they were exacting retribution for had lasted very long before the Paiwan attacked, so they were expecting something at any moment. They did have better weaponry than the Paiwan, who were using old, unwieldy, outdated muskets. The Marines had state-of-the-art post-Civil War rifles, the first of their kind to actually use the cartridges of modern bullets. And they had 181 men. Takatak and the Paiwan brought just 22 fighters to this campaign. At the one-hour mark, the jungle erupted in gunfire. The Americans hadn't realized it, but they were approaching a small but steep hill, and Takatak and his men had taken up a position at the top. By the time they reached that hill, the Paiwan were gone, and they pressed forward once Commander Belknap and the other column caught up, only to be attacked from the shadows and the trees in every direction as they marched further and further into the jungle. The Marines were pelted with heavy rocks, they dodged literal spears whizzing through the air, musket shots filled the forest with smoke, and the terrain was still dense jungle. Nobody was dead yet, but they were all dying of heat exhaustion. And then there was another volley of gunfire.
This may be an ignorant question, but why don't they just take off the wool at some point? Like, if you're losing that badly, you have no pride at that point. So just strip down, like, masculinity issue, maybe?
You know, I'm sure they did take off their coats, but there's only so much you can do once you're already in it, and you still have to carry all of that back.
And then I guess there's also, like, you don't know what plants are going to scratch you, and if you have open wounds. Okay.
Yeah.
I guess that's a fair point, but I just feel like I would immediately just take off everything if I were dying of heat exhaustion, but I've also never been to war, so.
There's also the just doctrinal issue if you can't leave your uniform somewhere where an enemy force can pick it up.
Oh, that's a good, that didn't even occur to me. That is a good point.
I can't imagine this enemy in particular doing anything with that, but that was, they had just come off of
right.
a much more real war. So that was probably part of their logic for not abandoning gear as they went.
Interesting. Good to know.
But yes, there's another volley of gunfire, and Lieutenant Commander McKenzie was hit, mortally wounded in the attack, and with his lieutenant dead, his men exhausted, and personally crippled by heat exhaustion, Commander Belknap ordered a retreat before they could get stuck in the jungle overnight. They dragged themselves out of the forest and sent the scouts along the way to look for any Paiwan who had been killed in the skirmishing as they had marched over the last 4 hours. They didn't find a single body. The Paiwan presumably shadowed this retreat, but they didn't attack this demoralized, dying group of soldiers and Marines on their way out. And that was it. The Formosa expedition was an embarrassing, largely bloodless defeat for the United States.
That's so not a single Paiwan died.
Not a single one.
That is so...
One U.S. Marine commander and no enemy forces whatsoever.
And they were outnumbered, what, you said 22 to 180?
Yeah.
Wow. That is pretty... Again, I know functionally nothing about military strategy, but the one they had was great.
Time and time again, the lesson is guerrilla forces in forests are a working strategy when an organized army comes in, and organized armies really struggle with that lesson.
Yeah, I feel like just as a general rule, when accomplishing any kind of task, dividing and conquering and being flexible is usually better than marching in a straight line and matching clothes just kind of across the board. But
bright blue matching clothes at this time, too. That is.
Oh, interesting.
Still how it worked in the 1860s.
Hmm.
So the kind of epilogue to this is that while all of this was going on, Consul Legendre was busy working on a diplomatic solution back in China. And what he settled on was eventually sending a letter through some Chinese intermediaries to Chief Takatak in order to establish a line of communication and at least get the Paiwan to stop killing everyone who washed up on shore. Legendre went with a steamship and some Chinese government officials, as well as a French diplomat, to meet with Takatak on his own territory and negotiate terms. They brought several crates of military surplus and trade goods as diplomatic gifts, and they arrived to find the great chief and 200 villagers, including several warriors who had fought the Americans, at all attending the meeting. Through an interpreter, Takatak explained that they killed white people who crashed in their territory as revenge for a genocide committed generations earlier, apparently by the Dutch, based on the geography of the situation. And they didn't totally understand that the English and the British weren't Dutch.
Fair. Kind of fair.
Which actually kind of makes sense. The languages don't sound that different if you're not familiar with them. And all three of them fly red, white, and blue flags.
Oh, that's a good... Wow. You know, think about that. That is a good point.
So, they didn't mean to be at war with the United States or the British Empire, because they thought they had been fighting the Netherlands this entire time.
Oops. And they still apparently did great, so...
Yeah, it worked real well for them, at least in the short term. But once the situation had been explained with intermediaries, both from other indigenous peoples and from China, this settled into an actual diplomatic relationship between the United States and the colonial empires and the Paiwan people. They established an agreement to repatriate shipwreck victims and open some mild trade between the Paiwan coastal villages and European and Chinese merchants.
Do you happen to know how many Paiwan people, like how many there are today? Is that still a tribe that is...
It is.
Identified?
I have it somewhere. Almost 100,000.
Okay. Interesting. All right. Good to know. Good to know.
They are the second largest indigenous group on the island today.
Wow. Oh, yeah. I guess that is... I didn't account for how small the population of the whole island probably is. Oh, good to know.
Yeah. And a majority population now is Han Chinese after the 1950s. But so, yeah, they were one of the larger groups on the island to begin with anyway. The one issue that Taka Tok would not budge on was establishing a Chinese fort in his territory. Understandably, he had seen how the Qing treated his neighbors in the lowlands, and he didn't trust them to keep their influence to the fort. There were some incidents around this in the years that followed, but eventually what they settled on was a Chinese fort right at the edge of Paiwan territory and a road leading further in. So there was a method of travel, but not an official presence. Kind of working on technicalities with that, I think, but it was enough to make an agreement. And this system worked. Ships continued to crash, but the murders and kidnappings all stopped. Taka Tok honored his agreement, so did the Americans and the British, and then another country went and got involved. This time it was Japan. And in my episodes that I talked about Japan around this time, I mentioned at the very end that one of the core lessons they learned from their first military encounters with the West was that if they wanted to keep up in this new system of world politics, Japan would have to become a colonial empire. So in 1873, the Empire of Japan started scouting along the Paiwan coast. And at the same time, there were a few American military advisors assisting the Japanese government. These were James R. Wasson and Douglas R. Castle, who had been given leave to privately serve as military advisors to the Japanese during their 1874 invasion of Taiwan. And along the way with this, they almost dragged Charles Legendre back to the island on the Japanese side. But he made the mistake of visiting Shanghai, and he was arrested because it turns out you can't take a job as a Japanese military advisor and not come back to your diplomatic posting whenever you want.
Hmm.
What followed here was a disaster for the Paiwan people. At some undocumented point between 1869 and 1874, Taka Tok had died, and the Paiwan had already started fracturing without any kind of centralized governing body to keep them unified, which the Japanese then exploited when they landed 3,600 soldiers to assault Taiwan. The Paiwan held out for 7 months, which was an impressive time against a much better armed and equipped foreign power. But in the end, they were conquered by Japan. And this settled a Japanese foothold on Taiwan that was used to launch the first Sino-Japanese War in 1894, which resulted in Japan annexing all of Taiwan, as well as Korea and the Penghu Islands, formally bringing the whole Japanese Empire up to about where they would be at the build-up to World War II. So despite all of the successes and diplomacy that resulted from the Formosa expedition, American military advisors ended up playing a key role in conquering it for a different empire anyway.
It's like when you arrive at the same answer as everyone else in math class, but you show your work and you did it wrong. You're like, I don't know if this counts, but here we are.
Yeah, I don't think it does in this case because... this would be the last time that American military personnel set foot on Taiwan until the 1950s, because relations with Japan started to decay a little bit in the 20th century.
So that's from the late 1870s up until like Great Leap Forward era, there was just not really much interaction there.
Well, so the western and southern parts of Taiwan remained kind of contested in the 1870s. So there was some very limited interaction with the Chinese presence there. But after 1894, nothing.
Wow. I don't know why that surprises me, but it does for some reason.
Yeah. And then it became a totally not an American colony. Which maybe that is arriving at the same answer, just doing it wrong.
True.
But that is the American Formosa expedition. Emma, do you have any final thoughts?
I mean, it is. I mean, I knew this from your initial description of what I thought was the Vietnam War, but the similarities are so striking and crazy to think that we then followed up with the Vietnam War and made several of those same mistakes again. And I now kind of want to go to Formosa Cafe. Definitely not the main takeaway, but it is a takeaway. That was really interesting. I think the kind of relationship between China and Taiwan it's interesting to me. And it's also, you know, again, living in Los Angeles, I know a lot of people who were born in China. I know a lot of people who were born in Taiwan or who are Taiwanese. And I feel like that it's interesting to see the, not only their opinions, but the opinions of like older people in their lives, like kind of watching that play out and listening to those different perspectives, you know, kind of has encouraged me to like look into the history and it's interesting to see. And that was quite an adventure. And I did add Belknap to, or Commander Belknap to my list of cat names, right below mesothelioma. So I will have two very unlucky cats at some point in my life.
What a name for a cat. Oh God, that poor animal.
Well, my cat has pneumonia and breathes in such a way that you would expect she has pneumonia. And I was like, I should have named her mesothelioma, but then I would have thought that I like karmically brought that into existence. So yeah, my cat name list is several dozen long, and none of those animals, they'll all resent me, basically. Every cat that I ever own.
Okay. That's how it's supposed to work.
Exactly.
But yes, if you want, now is the time to tell people about your work and where to find you.
Yeah, so I produced a podcast called Gooned. It's a 12-episode investigative series about the troubled teen industry. It's out and available on all platforms. We recently won a Shorty, which is really, really exciting. And I also produced Texas Twiggy in 2021 that was about Shelley Duvall and her life and career. I run Los Audio, a newsletter that centers around audio events in Los Angeles. You can submit your own events. It's a great community. I've met so many people out in person from that newsletter. And yeah, you can also find my other shorter audio and writing at emmalehman.com, L-E-H-M-A-N. And yeah, go listen to my podcasts. They're great. I promise I made them. So.
Yes. Well, I agree. And hearing about the work that you were doing on Gooned last year was part of the reason I wanted to make sure I got you on here to promote that a little bit. Everyone should go check that out. I will put links to Emma's work in the description of this episode. And if you want more information about this podcast, you can find me on social media at History of Persia, because I'm not maintaining separate social media accounts for these things. You can go to hopfulmedia.com. You can find me and support me on patreon.com/historyofpersia. More information about that specifically coming soon. And until next time, go get some dim sum, everybody.
Do it. It's a great idea. It's always a good idea.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.